Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This week's episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, a full-service regulatory compliance consulting firm serving the ambulatory surgery industry, and Eden Group Development, publisher of the ASC Regulatory Compliance series of books by John Gailey.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of ASC Podcast with John Gailey. I'm your co-host, Judy D'Ambrosio, and I'm happy to have you here. We have a great show in store for you, so I'm glad you're with us. But we're going to begin, like we always do, with some pieces of news, some little informational tidbits that you may find helpful. The first being a little discussion about how bad this flu season has become for everyone in the United States. So the CDC did have a little briefing on the 29th of January. Brenda Fitzgerald, she's the director of the Center for Disease Control. She's called this year's flu season challenging and intense. She notes that the most important things to remember are, one, to protect yourself from the flu by washing your hands often, and especially if you're caring for someone who is sick. Protect others by staying home when you don't feel well and seeing a doctor if you really are showing symptoms. And of course, the covering your mouth when you cough or sneeze. What's notable about this year that may be a little different from the years before is that this flu season, the activity became very widespread within all of the states at the same time. And the second is that the activity has stayed at the same level for 3 weeks in a row now, with all except Hawaii reporting widespread spread activity. And that's every week for the last 3 weeks. So there's a range of things that you can do in your practice to help minimize the exposure before arrival, upon arrival, and through the duration of a patient's visit to your center, most of which centers around your universal precautions and hand washing. So take steps to ensure that all the people that show symptoms adhere to those guidelines, the cough etiquette, hand hygiene, and try to triage them through quickly through your center. Provide face masks for people at your front desk so that if they have symptoms, they can put those on, and put up a sign that says, if you have any respiratory symptoms, please grab one of these and wear them while you're here. Provide them supplies to perform hand hygiene to all the patients upon arrival, at your entrance, in the waiting rooms, and throughout the entire time they're there visiting, remind them to wash their hands often. And also provide space for people that think they have symptoms to sit as far away from others as possible. I know that seems a little strange, but if it's available, facilities may want to wish to place patients in a whole separate waiting room. And again, this flu season has been a little out of the ordinary for its intensity and its duration. And because of the industry we're in, we just need to take a few steps to make sure we're not adding to the problem, you know, that we're part of the solution and not part of the problem. And again, you can go to the CDC's website for any questions you have and for more hints and ideas to help control that spread. Okay. I also want to talk a little bit about something that's a little different. I want to talk about the ASC's National Advocacy Day. So ASCA arranges each year for members of the industry to go out and meet their politicians, to meet members of Congress to talk about our industry. So you can register for this National Advocacy Day. It's open right now. And if you're actually one of the first 20 people, you get a little hotel credit, which is a nice little perk. So this year's Advocacy Day is September 5th, 2018, and registration is open now. And this is a fabulous opportunity. It gives you the ability to speak face-to-face with members of Congress and ask for their support for our industry. You get to visit Washington, D.C., speak face-to-face with members of Congress, and join other ASCA members from across the country to speak up for our industry. And your voice is more persuasive and has more importance than you think it does. And in case you're nervous about what you know and what you don't, the night before the Congress meeting, ASCA staff provides a little training session to prepare you for the meeting. You learn about what's going on in Congress and what legislation is being discussed and how you can speak up and ask your representative for more support. So it's a fabulous opportunity. It might be something you want to involve yourself in. And again, you can go to the ASCA site for more information. Okay, that's what I've got for this week. John, you had some state-specific stuff you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, before I get into that, I did want to kind of reemphasize what you were talking about. What you find when you participate in these advocacy days is that many of our legislators really do not know what an ambulatory surgery center is. They and this is an opportunity for us to give some good information to them about how our industry operates, what great care we provide, that indeed we provide better care than in the hospital in most cases, and that that we need to have all the legislative protections that we can get in order to assure our industry continues to thrive in the new healthcare environment.
Yeah, how can they work for us unless they know us?
That's absolutely
right.
So this
is perfect.
And it also helps you to learn a little bit more about how our government works, too. I mean, that's certainly an interesting advantage here. So on the state side, some of our listeners are no doubt from New York and New Jersey. So let's talk about two things that happened in New York and New Jersey, or things that happened in New York and New Jersey. In New York this last week, the Department of Health issued a new patient rights and responsibility document, which is required to be posted, which is going to be kind of interesting because it does not include all of the items that need to be posted for CMS and for your accrediting body. So unfortunately, our interpretation of this is that you're going to have to post this sign as it's provided to you by the Department of Health, and you'll have to have a separate form for that will meet the requirements of CMS and accreditation standards. In New Jersey, some new developments. State now has Governor Christie signed into law the long-awaited and debated bill that will require all one-room surgery centers in the state of New Jersey to be licensed. Up until this point, they have been allowed to operate under the auspices of the New Jersey Board of Medical Examiners, and now their oversight will shift to the New Jersey Department of Health, and there's going to be some significant changes with regard to oversight in the state. So I encourage any of those organizations to obviously keep up with all the requirements there and make sure that they're fully compliant with all the changes that will occur.
Thanks, John. That's good. Okay. We're going to take a little break right now before we go into the meat of our podcast. Stay with us. We're going to tackle some credentialing ideas to share with you. So stay tuned.
Okay, Amy, the survey is going pretty well so far. Thank you for all of your help. Now, let's do the big thing here. Let's start tackling your credentialing files.
Oh, can you give me a minute or two? We're not all that organized around here.
Oh, I can certainly give you some time, but organized credentialing files, are really important. Why don't you just look at it? Let's just see what you've got. I'm sure it's not as bad as you think.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Okay. Here they are. That's everything.
Well, you've certainly got an awful lot here. Let's see what you're working with. Let's start with the first one. Dr. Monk, he's an anesthesiologist, right?
Oh, God, him? He hasn't done a procedure here for years.
Then why is his file here?
Well, I told you that we weren't very organized.
Okay. Let's move on. How about this one? It's pretty thin. Who is Dr. Stabler?
Oh, yeah, him. He's a regular. A podiatrist. He's been here for quite a while.
Well, let's see what you've got. There's the original application. That's good. Here's this delineation of privileges. Wait, it lists colonoscopies and endoscopies here, and it's signed by both he and the medical director. Why would a podiatrist have privileges in colonoscopy and endoscopies?
Well, see, it's just, we use the same form for everybody. Podiatrist, gastroenterologist, anesthesiologist, it's all the ists. It's just easier to use one form.
Oh my. Well, we'll talk about that later. But look here, there is no other application or reapplication since the original one in 2011.
Well, why would there be? He's never left. He's been here that whole time.
But what about his peer review? What about continuing education, his malpractice? God, even his primary source verifications. All these things have to be checked every 2 years.
Well, but that would take forever.
Not if you make a process for yourself. Listen, don't panic. Let's look at another one. Show me the file for Dr. Lannister. His was the procedure that I observed, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't made his folder yet. He's new.
Oh, that's no problem. Let's just look at his application, his lineage and privileges, and his verifications. It's okay if it's not in a formal folder yet.
No, I mean, I don't have any of those things yet.
You must have. How can you be operating if you don't even have a signed delineation of privileges from the board?
The board has to sign off on those?
Okay, maybe you're right. We do have a problem.
Wow, John, each one of these scenarios we do together certainly does give you a lot to talk about. I'm just going to let you jump in anywhere here.
Well, and thankfully, these stories are meant to be exaggerated. I certainly hope that nobody that listens to these are saying, oh, yeah, that's me. Except maybe that scenario we did a couple of weeks ago on the governing body.
Probably is more them than they wish it was.
I got a little bit of feedback on that saying, so what's wrong with that? So, credentialing is a critical process, and primary source verification, verifying that all the physicians that you work at your center are appropriate to work at that center to do the procedures that they have requested is absolutely important. I like to refer to primary source verification as the catch me if you can. You might remember that famous movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. I think it was based upon a real story where Leonardo played an emergency room doctor put himself off as a licensed physician. And fortunately, in that case, he actually did a pretty decent job. But I'm not sure that that's the type of doctor that we want to have practicing regularly at our centers. So the purpose behind credentialing is to assure that the physicians that practice in our center, in our settings, are well-trained and skilled at the procedures that they perform, and that they have the appropriate credentials, appropriate licensure, and the ability to prescribe drugs, etc. And we know. I mean, even though many cases we know these doctors, we know them very well, we still have to do appropriate verification of this information. We have to do it regularly. So state licensure might require 2 or 3 year accreditation primary source verification and recredentialing. And certainly the accrediting bodies also require regular ongoing credentialing of providers. Critical to credentialing is the concept of primary source verification, which means that we go and we check with, that we don't just rely on the license, like Leonardo did in his movie, to make sure that they have a valid license in the state. So primary source verification is the process of checking the credentials of a provider against the original source of that information. So for example, if you want to check state licensure, you're going to check online with the state to make sure that the physician's or the practitioner's license is current. You're going to want to check that their education was obtained from the appropriate schools, either by getting a letter from that school, or the other alternative right now is to check the AMA database, which provides a lot of great information directly from the schools on primary source. Many of the professional organizations also have do primary source verification for organizations also. So rely on that. You also have to run a National Practitioner Data Bank report to see the history of that physician, whether there's any marks on his practice or on his practice, and see if there's any malpractice cases that he had had. I think, Judy, this scenario that we laid out also shows the importance of organizing your files. Amy clearly wasn't very organized with those files that she had there. And I know this is a strain. There's an awful lot of information that has to be gathered and kept up to date. but clearly having a nicely organized file, or nowadays I like to organize all my credential information, you know, right online or
electronically, which is much easier.
Yeah, we have folders for every one of the providers, and we never lose anything that way because everything is kept, you know, right in that folder. And surveyors will indeed be all right with you showing them a folder with all that information in there.
What I did like about this scenario, though, was how supportive and educational the surveyor was trying to be. That's okay. It's okay if you don't have a folder. Let's just see what you've got. Because you've always told me that that's how you approach people when you're surveying. And that's that Triple HC is more of a supportive thing than a punitive thing.
Right. I mean, all the surveying organizations really, you know, Triple HC, the Joint Commission, Quad ASF, all of them hopefully come into your organization with a very good attitude. They're there to be consultative. You know, obviously, our Amy here is going to have some significant marks
poor
off
Amy.
For her situation. But the surveyor handled, I thought, very well in that, you know, he was supportive of her and trying to get as much information as he could. You know, he didn't tell her, okay, this is not organized, therefore I'm not even going to look at it. He encouraged her to show her what she had. And he was, you know, certainly willing to look at that. I will state that often state surveyors probably won't necessarily be that consultative or that patient with the organization, but certainly accreditation surveyors should be. So, and another thing that's important here, we didn't really talk about that in the scenario we laid out, but we need to make sure upon recredentialing that there's ongoing peer review performed for each of the physicians that are practicing there. And that means that we can demonstrate that the physicians have been reviewed, their records have been reviewed, that all of their procedures are reviewed on a regular basis to make sure that the quality of care that's being provided is appropriate. I think upon our initial credentialing, the providers are going to provide peer references from their peers or from the hospital that demonstrate that they have privileges in each of those cases that they're doing. Upon recredentialing, we rely less on that. As a matter of fact, it's not always really required that you have those peer references, but what is absolutely required is that you have peer review, ongoing peer review to the governing body that shows that this ongoing...
And that peer review should be done by your colleagues there at the center.
Absolutely. Like colleagues. So you're going to want orthopedic surgeons reviewing.
You don't want a podiatrist doing an anesthesiologist.
Exactly right.
Okay, John, thank you for walking us through that. I'm sure credentialing is something a lot of our listeners have questions about. So we're going to let that sink in for a while. We're going to take a short break and then come back with listener questions. So stay with us. There's still a lot to be heard. So we have now come to the part of the podcast where we read one of our listener questions. So I have a question in front of me. This is a question from Philip. He's in a surgery center in Massachusetts. And this is his question. Oftentimes, providers will want to be brought on quite quickly, and they request temporary privileges. What do I need to do, at the very least, to get them credentialed to begin right away?
Thank you, Judy. I think there's this common misconception or a misconception in many organizations that temporary privileges are a means for bringing a provider on quickly while you're going through the credentialing process. And that really is not the case at all. Temporary privileges are designed so that a provider who has undergone the entire credentialing process can get approved prior to the formal approval by the governing body or whatever part of the organization does the final approval. So to do temporary privileges, you're still going to have to get, verification, primary source verification of the DEA, the National Practitioner Data Bank reports, make sure that the delineation of privileges is appropriate and signed off by the appropriate individuals prior to actually granting those privileges. So really, you're still doing everything you would do for the regular credentialing with a temporary privileges, The only difference is that you were not able to get the governing body to approve the privileges. So in that case, the medical director reviews the file that's been prepared by the administrator or the credentialing people, make sure all that information is accurate, follow up on any questions that you have, make sure you receive back from the peer references and from the hospital National Practitioner Data Bank, AMA, any of the schools that the person might have to have verification from. So all that information has to be in the file and ready prior to granting those privileges.
So basically what you're saying is you're doing exactly what you would do for normal privileging, except for the governing body meeting. It isn't a way to skip any of these steps. It isn't a way to, you do everything you would normally do. It's just you haven't had a time to have the meeting.
That's absolutely correct.
Oh, I think that is a common misconception. So this is good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we have to look at it from the standpoint of what we're trying to do to protect our organization. We don't want to use, or this system could be abused to bring people on board that are not properly vetted prior to coming to work at your center. It's always interesting to me when you do primary source verification or when you do background checks on some of these doctors that there are some interesting things back there, and you need to know about them. You know, malpractice cases that they've had, if they've had license issues in other states, you really want to nail all those things down before you grant them privileges. And a physician that's coming to your practice and saying he wants to be credentialed right away, there might be another reason for that. I worked on a legal case a number of years ago where I was working with the defendant, which was an organization that had credentialed a provider that it turns out had lost his privileges at a at another institution in another state and actually had lost his license in that state.
Oh, my.
And he had kind of quickly moved to another state, set up practice, and got privileges right away. And unfortunately, he had another bad outcome at this facility also. Those people that are asking for privileges right away, now they might just be somebody's friend who, you know, has always wanted to work there and just never got to, got the application in, but sometimes there's other reasons for that. And I think we have to be aware of that before we jump the gun and immediately grant them privileges.
That's a good answer. Excuse me. That's a good answer, John, because I think there was some misinterpretation of that. So thank you very much. And thank you, our listeners, for sending in your questions. Again, any question you have, no question is a stupid question. So send them in to us. We want to get you the information you need. So thank you for being with us. We're at the end of our time with you. Come back next week. We'll have another new show, another new question, and some new things to talk about. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Judy.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. Our other sponsor today is Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including The Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage, and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring with the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ASCpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ASCpodcast.com.